Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and I want to welcome the callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. Well, I am really excited tonight to have all of you join me. This is the second anniversary for Research at the National Archives Beyond Blog Talk Radio Show. And to date, I have had 110 shows broadcast at least once per week for the last 2 years. I can't even believe it myself. Now, I want to just acknowledge all of the wonderful guests who've been on my show. Without you, research at the National Archives and beyond would not exist. I also want to thank my wonderful co-host, Natan Elaine King. Natan gave me a much-needed break this summer and hosted over 8 episodes of Research at the National Archives and Beyond. She has also stepped in at the last minute. Thanks, Natan. I really appreciate it. And a special, special thanks to Valencia King Nelson of Afrogenius.com. Your generous support allowed me to broadcast weekly and post announcements in the Afrogenius.com calendar. By the way, have you liked the Afrogenius.com Facebook page? Please do it today. And I just have to thank my brother, Alvin Alexander. Alvin is the composer and producer of the opening and closing song, Sweet Mellow Spice. That's right, my brother Alvin is the producer of the opening song. And he is working on a new theme song for me for next year's show. Of course, I have to recognize Angela Walton Raji. Angela Walton Raji has shared highlights of the show on her African Roots podcast every Friday. Special thanks, Angela, for spreading the word about each episode. Also, Tony Carrier of Low Country Africana has also promoted the show through her work, her network. Well, you know the old saying, behind every great man is a great woman? Well, in my case, I have a very special man, and I'd like to give a shout-out to my husband, Glenn. He is behind the scenes posting my archive shows on my website, jeanniebroots.com, and making certain to keep the new shows up front for individuals to see. Thank you, Glenn. I love you. And I cannot forget the wonderful support and advice I have received from Antoinette Harrell. That's right, Antoinette Harrell. She has been engaged in the media for a long time, and she encouraged me to start my own blog talk radio show. In fact, I have about 8 episodes on Nurturing Our Roots, and moved to my own network in November of 2011. Well, with that said, I again must thank all of the special guests. I have enjoyed helping you to share your stories, hear and read your books, and learn new genealogical research strategies. It is because of you that I continue to offer this show to the general public. And if you would like to have your voice heard on Blog Talk Radio, drop me a big note. I am in the process of working on the new lineup for 2014. And guess what, folks? I'm going to have a new co-producer, but I'll let you know about that later. Well, I'm going to take a quick break and come back on with my special guest, Antoinette Harrell. Everyone, and as I said earlier, this is my second anniversary show, and the topic for tonight is leaving a legacy. Now, how many of you have even thought about what will you leave? What will your legacy be? Will it be your voice on Blog Talk Radio? Will it be documents that you leave to a university? Will it be a book? Well, we're going to talk about leaving a legacy tonight, and my special guest, I just love her so much, is Ms. Antoinette Harrell. Antoinette brings over 20 years of genealogical experiences that has resulted in the Antoinette Harrell Collection, located at the Amistad Research Center in New Orleans, and the Southeastern Louisiana State University. She is also the host of her own Blog Talk Radio show, Nurturing Our Roots, and a TV show, African Roots. She is the founder and editor of the Tangipahoa African American News. Antoinette is also a community activist. And she is one of those people who will not just talk about what should be done. She does it. And I love that about her. You know, her most recent advocacy work has resulted in assisting the black boys of the Dozier Reform School to tell their story. She also brought the word peonage to our vocabulary before we even heard about the book, Slavery by Another Name. Well, she also worked closely with Portland State University. I mean, Antoinette has done it all. So let me give a warm welcome to my friend, Antoinette Harrell. Welcome, Antoinette.
Thank you, Bernice, for having and greetings to having me as a guest, and greetings to you, and happy second anniversary. I'm so proud of you, and I wish you nothing but much success as you continue to grow.
Well, Antoinette, thank you so much because of you. You encouraged me to do a Blog Talk Radio show.
Well,
and it was something that I was saying, should I do this? You know, is this something I really want to do? And I'm having fun. I enjoy the guests, and I love the chatters. Hi, chatters. Glad to see all of you in the chat room tonight. Well, Antoinette, take us back 20 years. Please describe how your interests, let's start off with just whole social justice, evolved into genealogical research, family history, and later radio and TV, and newspaper.
Well, Bernice, everything derives from something. My mother, Isabel Harrell Cook, was a family historian who kept the oral history. And Bernice, I don't care when you call my mom, she always had the same stories tell you over and over and over again. It was like one day a light went off in my head and said, wait a minute, what is she trying to tell me? What should I be doing? So I just got a pencil and I got my tablet. I went out and bought myself a tape recorder and started recording those very things that my mother gave to me. About 8 years later, my mother had an aneurysm, and she do not talk about to this day all that information that she gave me prior to the aneurysm. My mother haven't even mentioned too much about it. So I knew then she was trying to pass it on to me to take it to another level. And that's basically how I got started, through my mom.
Well, that's wonderful, because it's because of her that we have an opportunity to hear about all of the wonderful things that you've done. So that's fantastic. Well, where do you want to start? What's your beginning?
Anywhere you want to start. There's so much. You just pick the topic, and I'm going to go with it.
Okay, well, I Googled your name. I Googled your name today, and guess what popped up? Antoinette Harrell, Ted Koppel, Times Magazine. Tell us about it, Antoinette. What did you do to have this interview with Ted Koppel?
Well, Bernice, it was basically going back to genealogy research again. And, of course, when you're conducting genealogy research on your family, you are basically looking at a community. And I could not understand why I couldn't find any of my family members in that sharecropping period. And then I soon learned why, because a lot of the people that went into that second coming of slavery that I call known as sharecropping, well, my family didn't sharecrop very long, maybe I think a year. Well, it was the sharecroppers who I met that end up signing their names on contracts that they could not get out of, and that new form of slavery called penance and involuntary servitude kind of crept up on them, and that's how I got an interview with Ted Koppel, because he was helping me to expose this hidden truth about slavery, the new covenant of slavery, and the new disguise that slavery had taken on.
Okay, all right. And then when you started looking at sharecropping, just what did you uncover?
Well, Bernice, I thought like everybody else that knew very little about sharecropping, except for, you know, they stayed on the land, they gave up a portion of the crops, and in return they received housing, clothes, some food, and some medical coverage, right, or whatever it was. But I found there was another layer, deeper layers than what I was taught about. And I found that some families was in a system of slavery. And so it had me to look deeper and deeper into records, into oral history, into traveling to some of those areas to talk with families who was held as sharecroppers. And so I'm very grateful that my great-grandfather, Alexander Harrell, and his father, Robert Harrell, they knew what that sharecropping system meant, so they worked very hard to purchase their own land and to grow their own food. And that's how we did not end up in slavery, in a new form of slavery.
Now, I know you also, you went to the Mississippi Delta. And so tell us about what you found when you began your research in the Delta.
Well, what I found was people living in conditions that was very hard to accept in America. You would have thought that you were staying in some third world country, and with Mississippi being the poorest state in the nation, well, you found, and in order to be called the poorest state in the nation, there had to be some very hard things to title it that. Well, it was people still living in the year the 2000 and 2005, 2010, without indoor plumbing, electric, not enough food to eat, conditions that you just would not have thought of in America. And what took me into that area is still conducting genealogy research again. You know, I knew that my family came down from Dalton, South Carolina. And when they came down from South Carolina, they went to Mississippi, the Mississippi Territory. Well, anyway, they end up in Amick County, Mississippi, but there were some Harrells that went out into the Delta. And so when you follow these names and you follow the trails, it led me to a place where, oh, my goodness, you know, Bernice, it was, and the people who was left behind in that time and period was a lot of the elderly people who was too old to migrate up north or go somewhere else. They was left behind with the babies. So there was a lot of people that left the Deep South and went out to look for factory jobs in Chicago and Detroit, and they left the children with their mothers. And sometimes they left the children in the house with somebody like themselves that could have been 10, 11 years old. And so there was a lot of homes during that time that had children that was here in the house at 10 years old. With maybe 10, 15 children in the house.
Yeah, so you really encountered some serious issues as it related to sharecropping and poverty. But how did you get the word out so that others would know what was going on? And what did you do from an advocacy perspective to help the people?
Well, it was a very slow process of trying to get people just to write about it, blog about it, speak on their radios about it, television talk shows. Well, it came, but it came a little slow. So it had to become an activist movement where, you know, we had to go and collect food and clothes and winter blankets and socks to give to the people there. So it was people like Brother Nasi, Nathan and Nasi, and other people that helped to pack U-Hauls and buses of clothing and food to bring to the people in Mississippi. Just here recently, I was in Mississippi 2 weeks ago, and we're getting ready to open up a library in Webb, Mississippi. Of course, it's a community resource library. And so I was contacted by one of the producers of the Al Jazeera show, and he's going to do an 8-minute little documentary that would help the youth ambassadors of Amick, Louisiana, to help them get the word out about books and artists to come down and paint the building and stack the rooms with the books, you know, the bookshelves, and donate computers. So that's the mission that I'm working on before I say, okay, it's enough now. It's time for me to sort of retire a little bit now because I've been in the Delta for a very long time.
But it sounds like you're still moving. You're still going. It's not stopping you.
Yes. And it's all a part of, you know, Bernice, it's like you that love for humanity kicks in. It's not like you can just go and see people suffering and, you know, I'm trying to conduct this oral history, I'm trying to do my research, but yet I see a child that's hungry or an elderly person that needs a blanket. So, you know, that's the time that I say, okay, you know, put the research aside and try to do something to help somebody.
Now, you know, when you speak of trying to collect oral history and document what's going on, have you worked with any of the communities to just document the oral history of the communities?
Oh, yes. A lot of the people there, extensive interviews I've had with them, interviews that we're preserving now and trying to get them in the libraries or the archives, because a lot of the people are talking about their life on these different plantations, who they worked for, you know, the kind of life that they had. So that is very important to be able to document the oral history. You know, people may not realize how important it is, but we're talking to the direct descendants of sharecroppers and sharecroppers themselves. People who, Bernice, are still living on plantations, not moved off plantation, but still on plantations.
And by them documenting that information, where is it going?
I am putting it in the state archives, universities, libraries, different places. I am also using the internet to archive some of these oral history collections that I have, not just from the elderly people, but from the young people as well, because we want to hear from them what life is like living in those remote rural places without a doctor's office, a library, supermarkets, those sort of things, and how they end up working on plantations as young as they are, you know. You and I couldn't imagine that, but that is the way of life for a lot of people.
Right. It certainly is. Well, Antoinette, now I know that in your community, and perhaps you want to tell people just where your community is, that you have managed to get the people in the community to trust you to the point where they are bringing you documents and photos and showing you things that perhaps the ordinary person would not see. How did you get the community to come to you with this information?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question because it took me sometime 2 to 3 years just to build a relationship, and certainly a trustworthy relationship. And one, I realized that a lot of the people that I came across in those communities was in impoverished conditions. So the first thing, I would always go with something in my car, whether it would be food, blankets, coats for children, or school supplies. And people know that you really care when you do that. And so they open up and they share what they have with me. Mm-hmm. And so that meant a lot to me. And sometimes just giving them something, if they shared something with me, I wouldn't take their photograph, but I always went with my own computer and my scanner. So that trust, that was something else that was very important to earn and to keep that trust. And that's very important to me in everything that I do, is to make sure I keep a trusting relationship, and my word is my bond. And that's something that our ancestors, my grandfather and his brothers, you know, they shook hands, and if they said something, that was their word. And that's the way I kind of walk in their footsteps with that.
Mm-hmm. But what about, you know, those folks who are just hearing about you? What are you doing to encourage them to share their documents and photos and stories?
Well, a lot of people here in the areas that I work, they're so excited just to see their family name in print or their mm-hmm. family photograph in some newspaper or blog or on television. And when they tell somebody else, or share it with someone, where they put me in contact with other people, because I'm collecting a lot of information, lots of information. And so when I scan some of the documents, I know that the library will accept it, and they really enjoy knowing that they are leaving a legacy. But first of all, I really have to spend some time educating them on the importance of sharing and preserving that family history, because I also find a greater percentage of a lot of people still want to hold on to that photograph. They don't really want to share it. But then again, you hear about the house was burned down and, you know, we lost this hurricane, so now we don't have that picture. So it takes some education to do that, to let them know that they're leaving a legacy when they share it with some repository that someone else can come behind them and learn from what they have documented.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just brought up another word here, repository. Now, I know that there are two Antoinette Horrell collections. Is that right?
That's correct.
One at the Amistad. And so tell us about the collections. Tell us how you organize them, and why did you select the two places you selected to leave your documents?
Well, I selected Amistad because my work as an activist was not, it really wasn't just about my family history. It was my work as an activist in New Orleans. And because I had really been in, as an activist around a lot of politicians in New Orleans, a lot of mayors, a lot of different meetings with the community. And so documenting that with photographs or if newspaper clippings came out about whatever we was doing, I saved all that information. And so I thought it would belong in New Orleans. And so New Orleans has an extensive, the Outside has a very extensive collection of some of my political activist work that I did in New Orleans. And so in the process of that, I added some things like my African ancestry DNA trip to Africa, to Niger, and also some of my family records. Now, at Southeastern University in Caswell Parish, which is in Hammond, Louisiana, I select that university and the history department there because most of the material that I collect from the people in Caswell and St. Helena should go into Southeastern because they can access that repository easier than they could in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my choice, yeah.
Right. Now, is this information online? I mean, how can individuals find out what's in the Antoinette Harrell collection?
Oh, yeah. They can go to Southeastern Louisiana University and just type in my name, and that collection will come up, and they will look at the extensive titles of the folders and the boxes. And so, first of all, let me just say this. Whenever I put a collection together to go anywhere, it takes me almost a year to prepare that collection because I have to organize that collection very well, put the folders there, and then I make my own index because there's so much that I'll forget what I have myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so with doing that, I'll spend, let's say if it's a folder on the Harrell side of the family. Well, if I have something for the Harrells, I put it in this folder. There's something for the Butlers. So I sort of organize everything. The obituary collection, the funeral programs, what I did, I made an index of all the names before I gave it to the Southeastern University. And so that was a very important decision to make, to get that information out of my home. And what really, really put the fire under me to do that was when I had that aneurysm 2 years ago and I came back to a new birth, I knew that I had to do something. It's one thing to research, to collect, to record. Now what are you going to do with it?
Yes, yes.
What are you going to do with it?
And you can find yourself with a whole room, a whole house full of original documents. Now, these were original documents that you donated to Amistad and to Southeast.
Yes, yes. The Amistad only take the original. Southeastern will take copies, just like a library. So I like to preserve in different places, and everybody have a different standard. But now you have to understand that when you donate this collection, it's no longer your collection. You don't have a right. You can't go in and say, okay, I want to take this back. You have donated. You have some authority over the collection, but you really can't take it out. And just like if something happened to me, my children can't go back and say, oh, give me my mom's stuff. No, I signed it over to them.
It is their property now.
That's right.
Now, there's a question coming out of the chat. Do you have any advice on how to approach institutions to give your donations?
Yes, I would say make an appointment, whatever place you decide, if it's the state archives or university, a library, why don't you just call and make an appointment. Let them know that what you want to come and talk to them about. And go there and look at what is their procedure. How do they, how would they protect your items that you're donating? That's very important because every place is totally different, and I know you know because you went to the Amistad and they bought out the boxes. You had to, show your driver's license and make sure that you don't have anything, no pencils, no ink pens, any of that, those things. Well, it's the same when you go to Southeastern University or the Louisiana State University, but a library is totally different. So I would not put any original documents in a library at all. At all. There's no security in there. And I can give you an example of that. I was at the AMIT Genealogy Library, and I was in an archival room just recently. And I noticed that some European family had donated these beautiful photographs, original photographs. One, it was in the room by itself, along with, and I can bring my briefcase in, you can bring, pencils, that shouldn't be. So you want to make sure you go and look at how do they preserve that material before you make a decision to donate your family records there, because it's just like saying if they're not going to make sure that your family records are secured, well, it can walk out that library or it can walk out that place. So you want to make sure you go in there and just look at, what's in between, preserving in a public library, a state archives, or a university.
Right. And someone is just asking for clarification when you say you wouldn't donate to a library. You mean just a local public library?
I would not donate original photographs and original documents to a public library, to the genealogy department. Absolutely not. I wouldn't do it. I would donate copies, but I would not put my originals in there.
Right. Well, with your collection, do you know if either of the institutions are planning on digitizing them?
No, most of the time you don't have, it's like the Amistad, no, they will not digitize anything. You would stand a better chance of having something in a digital format if it's a university. Maybe. But with all the fundings being cut right now, it'll be a long time.
Now, when you I want to go back a few steps, because this leaving your materials is very important, and I wonder how many people would even write something in their wills where they want the information to go. And what advice would you give to someone about original documents that they have collected that's in their home? I mean, what should they be thinking about right now?
Well, they should be thinking about, what do I want to happen to my records? If there's someone in the family who you want to donate those items to, that should be a part of your will. Now, you should start thinking about what it is, that is the third phase of your genealogy. What do I do with all of my family records now that I have collected this very extensive, all these records I have? How long did it take me? I have original copies. What am I going to do with them in the event that something happened to me or I become too ill to even deal with this collection? And when I spent all of those afternoons going through my material, the first thing I said to myself, this would not have been fair to my sons, because first of all, they don't know a lot of the people, and so their intentions may be well just by putting them in a box and hold on to them. But you know what happens over the years when you put things in a box and put them in the attic or you put it in the garage. Sooner or later, somebody will clean the garage out, and out goes the original document.
That's right.
And if so, while you have that opportunity to speak to your children, your adult children, about what it is that you want and let them know how valuable this collection is to you, not only just in the will, but in a conversation with them over lunch, over dinner, just having tea or something, let them know just how important this is, especially, for that child that may be more responsible. And sometimes their jobs and their occupation or family life just doesn't give them that time to really deal with that collection like you would want them to deal with it. So it's best that you deal with it yourself, because nobody can do what you would do with it.
Now, you said it took you an entire year to get your collection together so that you could donate it. Give us some advice. Go through the steps of exactly what do you need to do before you even have this information ready to be sent to somebody.
Yeah, the first thing I had to do, I just really had to purge all my file cabinets, look at what was on the shelf, look at my photographs, And each time I do that, I go out and I get three boxes, one for the Amistad, one for the Southeast University, and one for the library. And then I'll have a little pile on the side for somebody in the family that I may want to donate something to. So when I'm going through this, the decision is, okay, where do I want this to go? Which place is the best for this document here? And so it took me 1 year just to go through that information, because remember now, I'm still collecting. People are still giving me things. Mm-hmm. Every time I think I'm finished, somebody come and give me something else. But I do have a cutoff period. I said, okay, well, let me just do with this, deal with this, and every 2 to 3 years I go back and make another donation to those repositories. But those three boxes are very important. It may take me up to 2 months just to put the material in the box, because mm-hmm. I have to purge the files. So that means I go through all of my inventory. I go through everything, and I sit there. And things that I forgot that I had, because it's not like you're looking at it every day. You know, right. What am I going to do with this? Yeah. And so you thought, oh, I didn't know I had this. And so you have to make that decision. And I believe I made the wisest decision that I ever could have made concerning my family history, is by selecting repositories to donate my family records to.
Mm-hmm. And so you provided the university and Amistad Center with an index of the documents.
Exactly.
And you categorized these documents and had them in special archival boxes and folders?
No, I did not. Once you bring it to them, the Amistad will do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And Southeastern will do it depending on what it is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when I bring it to them, it's in folders. Uh-huh. And I will bring it to them, and they will take it from there. And now here's another thing. After you put all your information in the repository, you need to go back at least twice a year to look at your own collection to make sure things are there. And so
mm-hmm.
let's say I have three indexes available, right? Well, I put one index in the library. Each place I leave another index to say, well, look, okay, if you don't find it, let's go to Southeast University. Now, a lot of people like to put all their records in one place. Sometimes that's not possible to do so. Of course, we would like to have all your records in place. Let's take, for instance, Dutch Moriel. Well, all of his information, Mark Moriel made that decision to put his father's things in the Amistad. Well, you
mm-hmm.
wouldn't find anything in LSU Special Collections unless somebody was doing business with him and they made that decision to donate their things to LSU Special Collections. But most of the times when people try to make a donation, they try to put everything in one place.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a question coming out of the chat. Is there an ongoing relationship you still have with both institutions and archivists?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, because, as a matter of fact, a lot of them know of the work I personally do in the Mississippi Delta or the community. And so they know that I'm going to come and see them soon because I found something, I came across something. Like, for instance, I'm going to give you something I came across. I came across a sharecropping book, a day book, where they would list how many pounds of cotton the person picked, what plantation, what year. Well, that book was given to me. And so when I took it to the Amistad, and let me say, the Amistad will appraise your collection.
Oh,
and that's something
okay.
else. Yes, they will have your collection appraised just to see what it is. Now, sometime I'll come across a rare magazine or
mm-hmm.
a book, and so just to see what the price is on that magazine or what that magazine is selling for, I'll go on eBay and just to see what it is. And I've came across some magazines that was pricey, let's say about $45, $50, so that way you know what you're giving away.
Mhm. Mhm. Now, what about all of these photos? Because you're in a community where people are just giving you photos. What are you doing with those photos, and how are you identifying the people in the photos?
Well, that's a very good question too. a lot of times I collect these beautiful photographs and no one knows who it is in the photograph. But it may be a photograph that can be important to the historical education of the area.
Mm-hmm.
Although we may not know the person, but it may be of something, activity in church, or it may be a juke joint picture, something like that in the 60s. And so we are able to use that photograph in more ways than one. Although we may not know the person, and I try, and whoever's donating the material to me or the photos to me, I will ask them if they know the person. And sometimes, you know, more often than I would like to admit, a lot of times people really don't know who it is in the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And
which,
that's something,
which,
too.
Yeah. That, yeah, well, mm-hmm. it, those who are listening, and I know everybody knows how important it is to label the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
To say who's in the picture, when the picture was taken, because
mm-hmm.
Memories slip, you know, they slip real quick. And, I mean, I even look at my own collection of photos, and I do have a lot of photos. And some I have not labeled because I'm trying to rely on my memory, and I know that won't do. That
please
will not
don't
do
that.
That's mm-hmm. the one thing you don't want to do. That you want.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
see, you may be healthy today, like any of us, and then something happens tomorrow, and there it is. You may not even be able to recognize your own aunt or your own uncle. And so, I learned not only from what happened to me, but some of my genealogist friends who had spent years collecting.
Mm-hmm.
And they passed away, and their children didn't do anything with those collections. And so I know sometimes we say, you know, I'm going to get around to it, you know, next year. But you need to have a things to do list and just give yourself that time. I always try to purge my files starting in October, so at the first of the year I really start off very fresh. And so
mm-hmm.
I really set up a nice system now that when I collect now, you know, I want to make sure I have it out within that year so it wouldn't be so much. Because I'm going to tell you, Bernice, I started off early in the morning with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. Take a break. I actually had to walk outside and just look at the clouds and the beautiful trees to get my head out of those files because it
mm-hmm.
can be overwhelming. It really can.
Right, right. And then you just have people who are just collectors. It's just collecting, but what you're saying is move that collection. I mean, this is pretty much a call to action to all the listeners. I mean, you have your collections, and now, you know, people are digitizing their collections, putting them in the clouds, but what are you doing with that paper?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
yeah.
See that, and sometimes we think that, you know, like our kids may look at a letter and say, wow, why is she saving this? But if you look at some of the collections of the Amistad, just the envelope with the letter inside of it. And so these days when nobody's not really doing too much of handwriting, you know, and so those handwritten letters are very important, you know, especially if you, like, my work as an activist is very important. And I don't think my sons really understand, and let me just say this here, you know, the work will become more important to them when I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything, because of all the work that I've done, all the people I've worked with, and sometimes those things does not come out until after you have passed away, and
mm-hmm.
then it will come out. I can tell you, I was talking with Leonard a couple of weeks ago, and he said, Antoinette, I had no idea that you came in contact with all the political people that I did in New Orleans, for all those years. So not only did I have my work as a community activist, but I had my work as an advocate for reparations. And so
mm-hmm.
I had all of these things with People Magazine, Time Magazine, the case that was filed, the families at the press conference in Chicago, you know, whatever it was. So I donated that type of material to the Amistad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a comment, Angela, saying, you know, when the clouds fade and the company shut down, the paper is still there. So saving the paper is important. And if it means putting it in a repository, it's very important because you, like you said, you do have the original documents. And they are being preserved at a place, in a secure place.
That's right. And that was
100, 200 years from now. Right, yeah. But that's leaving that legacy. That's that legacy. And it's something that, you know, all of us need to think about. What are we going to do with all of the documents we have collected?
And that's a major, major question, a major decision that we all should make, because those records was not doing me any good in the house, although I used them. But now look at how many students that may want to write their dissertation on their thesis or writing a book. And so that means you're writing your family into history by having that information in a university or archives. How could anyone learn about the area if we don't? Let me give you a prime example of that. Professor Hyde, and you spoke with him over at Southeast University.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was no relationship between the blacks and the whites as far as preserving their history. So what Dr. Hyde said in his own words, he said, we don't have enough black history of this parish in our repository. So I said, okay, we're going to change that. And so, you know, it was the first extensive collection added to the Southeastern collection there about the local people. And when I tell you, I'm learning so much about the black cowboys, the Choctaw Indians. It's just so much that I'm documenting that I almost need to write, get a 501c3 and apply for grants just to collect the history and preserve the history in St. Helena and Tangipahoa Whole Parish.
Right. And once again, a call to action, because people are coming from communities in which they have a black population, but the history is not there. It has not been written. It has not been written. And so if you're right, if you're going to collect information and it has your family name in that, that you've just put your family in history. Others
That's
will go
exactly
in and look at
did.
Those documents, and they'll see the Harrell family, or they'll see other families in that community. And that's something to think about. That is something to think about. You know, there's another comment coming out. There's room for everyone to document their various communities of interest. And that is so true. That is so true. I mean, you know what's happening with the group from Edgefield, the heritage seekers. So the stories, as Family Tree Girl is saying, need to be told. And this is the opportunity that we're trying to promote, you know, right here on Blog Talk Radio. The stories need to be told. You need to think about what that legacy is going to look like. But we're going to take a quick break, Antoinette, and come right back, okay?
Sure.
At the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and you have been listening to Antoinette Harrell discussing leaving a legacy. And this is my second anniversary show tonight, and I'm so happy to have this as my topic, because after all, anyone who has been on Blog Talk Radio, you have left a legacy. Do you realize that? Your voice is there. And so, Antoinette, let's talk about television and radio, and give us an example of some of the work that you've been doing in both mediums.
Yeah, Bernice, well, I've been on television now for 13 years in New Orleans, and basically talking about genealogy research and interviewing people about their family history. My guests would come on and talk about their family history. So I moved it to the radio because then I thought I could really move around the state of Louisiana and Mississippi to learn more and to interview and to collect more. But just recently, NOA TV in New Orleans, Louisiana, have bought our shows to the Internet now. And so now people can join us right there on the Internet and look at the television shows. And if you are in the New Orleans, Louisiana area and would like to be a guest on a TV show, it's open. I want to hear. I want to share. I want you to share your history with us, as well as the radio. So that's very important that we have discussions like this. And, Bernice, I deal with a lot in family history. It's not just about the research. It's about building the family, trying to, because I can see a separation in the generations. You know, a lot of the elderly people do not talk about the past because the young people don't want to hear it. And so they shut down. And so, you know, by talking about family and the importance of our family history, reclaiming our legacy, you know, that's very important, because when you're researching your family history, there's so much that you can come across. Family land, family antiques, so much. It's just so much. And so I use those shows to promote family. That's what I do.
That's wonderful. And I'm looking at a comment that's coming out of the chat from Janice, and she's just talking about black folks have wonderful histories. You know, that's why in Chicago they published their own history book to get some of those histories and genealogies in print. So, you know, it's just something that needs to be encouraged, as you're saying, and the more you can talk about it, and especially, you, as you said, this gap, this kind of generation gap, where the elderly people are not communicating with the younger people, or put it vice versa, they probably would if the young people wanted to hear what they had to say.
Exactly. That's right.
You know, it's amazing sometimes, Antoinette, when you talk to people about oral history, and the first thing they tell you is that nobody told me anything. And I often wonder, is it that nobody told them anything, or they were not listening? What do you think?
It's a combination of both, because I found that sometimes when the older people do not want to talk about their life as a young person, they shut down and they don't want anybody to know anything, because now they're up in age and they're saved with the, you know, they would say they are living a whole different life now, and it's a religious perspective then. And younger people, they are just disconnected from the history once again because we are not sharing it. And so I decided to do something totally different with my grandchildren, where I make history come alive, whether that's through quilt making, recipes, or planning food. And that's one of the legacies that was passed down to me, since we were talking about leaving a legacy. The legacy that my great uncle Palmer Harrell gave me was planning food. And so now, Bernice, we're looking at, you know, families are losing their jobs, but look how many of us really knew and had that legacy of farm and planted passed down to us, but we want everything so quickly, like the microwave, everything. So I was very happy to pass that legacy of planting food and, to my grandchildren. And we have orange trees now, satsumas. We have fresh herbs in the yard. And so that's the legacy that has been in my family for a very long time, and I don't ever want to see it pass away. Now, outside of my family, it is something almost like something of the past.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned quilting. I mean, quilting is something that certainly I grew up seeing my mother do. And every person in the family has a quilt that she made, and she left the pattern. She left the pattern so it could be picked up by someone, one of the grandchildren, because she definitely did teach my nieces how to quilt, but clearly there's so much to leave, so much to inspire people to continue the family history and family traditions. And, of course, the planning. How many of us have gotten so far away from that?
Mm-hmm.
I remember my daddy
mm-hmm.
calling it a victory garden. You know, he had this
mm-hmm.
garden. And what, you go to the store and you buy vegetables that don't even look like vegetables that grow in the yard. They have
That's
strange
right.
looks and taste different with
right.
all these
That's
hybrid
right.
seeds. So it's definitely a challenge when you talk about that legacy. Well, let's move into another area. And this is an area that you have worked on, I think, for about a year, and that's with the Dozier Reform School.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell everybody about Dozier and how you got involved?
Well, Dozier Reform School that was opened in 1901, and it closed down in 2011. It was a reform school for boys. And because of my work in Penage and always researching to see if there has been any new development or cases that has been filed against Penage, well, I came across a man named Roger Dean Kaiser who wrote a book about being abused and at Dozier Reform School. So I reached out to Roger to talk to him about some of the things I had read on the internet, and he put me in contact with some of the black men who was boys at Dozier Reform School in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. Well, after talking to those men and interviewing those men and listening to these men who worked as modern-day slaves as little boys, I knew that Penage was there. And so
mm-hmm.
I dug a little deeper just to look at some records, and there was I found that Penage was taking place. It's just that it was in the form of a school. And so with that, then there's another hat that I wear. The black men was not getting the exposure that they needed in the media with telling what happened to them in their childhood experiences at Dozier. So then I sort of became that agent to help them to get their story heard by organizing press conferences, taking them to the Tallahassee State Archives, reaching out to the Attorney General Pam Bundy, and introducing them again to work with Dr. Eric Kimley, the anthropologist there at USF. And so with saying that, they are there at the school right now. They're excavating all of the remains of some of the black children that was murdered there or died there at the school on the black side of the campus. Well, there's this one man in particular named Johnny Lee Gaddy who saw the children's hand, one of the boys' hand, in the hog pen. And so People Magazine just published an article on it last week, but it has been all over the media, and I'm pleased to announce that and happy to announce that the Black Boys at Dozier Reform School has finished their book, and it will be available for purchase on November the 15th, the dark horrors at Dozier Reform School. And so I'm very happy for them. And I tell you, Bernice, when we talk about conducting our genealogy research and we find that somebody is missing in the family, we have to look at those reform schools. We have to look at the asylum records. We have to look at the chain gangs, because sometimes that's what happened to our family members.
Uh-huh.
Now, we all know that the 1940 census just came out. Well, these men was there in the 50s. There was one that was there in 1930. So we can't find them. It could possibly well be that we need to look in these type of places. And so this was some horrible things that took place with these children. Very,
yes.
Very horrible things.
Mm-hmm. And some people may put this under the category of forensic genealogy. I mean, you're really digging into some very difficult topics of which you may have a reaction or a results that you didn't expect. And like you're saying, start digging. You're digging deep now with missing people. And where do you need to go to find missing people? It's coming out. There's a comment saying that this is heartbreaking. And I've listened to the shows, and I've listened to the men, and I've listened to their wives. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation that they will live with for the rest of their lives. And now the story is out, though.
That's right. And that's somebody's family members. When we think about them, we're conducting our genealogy research on our own family history, and we said, wait a minute, where did they go? We know that they was here, but what happened to them? You know, and it's like it leads you to a cold trail and you can't find them. And then sometimes we have to look in places like that to see where, because now we're talking about a school that was open from 1901 to 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So how many times did we start looking in the 1900 census? You know, from 1870 to 1940. And so that's a lot of children. And not only did the school just carry just in that area of Mariana, but children came as far as Miami, Tampa, all around the state of Florida to go there. So once again, those stories was very hard. And a lot of the children that end up there, their families was poor. They just couldn't afford, you know, school clothing and things like that. But I'm very happy that these men will now tell their story in a book.
Well, I'm happy that they had you to serve as their advocate and advisor and to help them get their voice out there so that people could hear what they had to say. And speaking of voice, you are a Blog Talk Radio host. What kind of advice do you give or would you give to those who you would want to share their legacy? And perhaps Blog Talk Radio might be one of those arenas for them to consider. But what advice would you give people?
You know, I really like what you – everyone has a way of having their voice heard, whether that be through – producing a documentary in the form of what Lena do, or whether it be what Angela is doing, blogging and her podcast. I think that if everyone finds something that makes them happy with telling their story, whether it's in writing a journal or whatever it may be, because everyone do not like to be on the radio or telling in the form of radio, but I would just say document it.
Mm-hmm.
Just record it. Make sure you preserve it, because somewhere down the line, someone is coming, if they're not already here, that would want to know that family history. I just wish I had a little bit more history on my grandmother's side, on my grandmother, but I just found that recently. And let me tell you something. The reason it's so good to have good relationships with people, my second cousin passed away, and his son posted up pictures on the Internet. And I asked him, I said, do you have any pictures of my grandmother? And he said to me, I wouldn't know what she looked like. And that's his grandfather's sister. So that let me know right there that we have to find that way through the media, through radio, through television, through blogging, through magazines, newsletters, to help our folks understand that it does take the village. We're weak because we're not together as a family like we used to be a long time ago. And if you look at the census, Bernice, they live down the road from each other, or down the street from each other, or on the land somewhere. Now, if we go back and we wait till the census come out in, let's say, the 1980, which many of us will not be here, but you will not find family living in the same area at all. So the strength of the family is weakening down, and so we need to use every media that we can to talk about building stronger family ties.
That's right. And, you know, Angela has just posted that we have so many options about getting the word out about our genealogy and leaving our legacy, writing, talking, teaching, acting, collaborating, coordinating events, books. I mean, the opportunities are there. It's just that you have to, I guess, find what makes you happy and do it. You know, write
exactly.
that book, tell that story, organize that play, but do something. Do not spend the rest of your life living, and when you're gone, nobody has anything to remember you by. It's leaving a legacy.
Bonnie. Leaving a legacy.
Leaving
you know,
a legacy.
And that's what I think about. I thought about my family, leaving a legacy. And when I'm gone, when I'm no longer here, and as I reincarnate myself in my granddaughter by teaching her, you know, teaching her the importance of the family history, taking her on these trips with me. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm planting that seed early so that
mm-hmm.
when it's my time to retire, I can pass it on to my granddaughter.
That's right. Well, do you have any words of wisdom before we close out tonight?
Yes, I would like to say, first of all, I just say get started. Just do something, and believe me, believe that legacy. And to all of you genealogists, okay, now you have recorded, you have researched, you collect. It's time for you to make that decision to bring it out to the library. Because remember now, every history book is about something or someone or event. And you know what? History will not change. The books will not change until we start to document our history in those and tell our own story. Like Angela
mm-hmm.
just said, write the book, like Lynn is doing, producing documentaries, like you are doing, hosting, and you are author yourself. So we are
mm-hmm.
changing history. All I can say is just get started. Listen to the inner voice inside of you.
That's right.
It will lead
that's
you.
That's right. Let's get started. In fact, I want everybody to just tune in next week because we're going to have the African American genealogy bloggers on next week. Angela Walt Raji, George Jeter, Melvin Collier, and Nika Smith. And they're going to discuss the PBS special African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. Now, this is going to be just an exciting show. And Angela's going to be the host of that show next week. So I really hope that everyone will tune in next week to hear the African-American genealogy bloggers. You know, there's a whole circle out there, and they're just blogging and telling these wonderful stories. Keep the stories coming. Keep them coming. So, Antoinette, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me. And once again, may the Heavenly Father bless you on this journey that you're on. And thanks, everyone, for listening in.
Thank you so much. And remember, everybody, your ancestors left footprints. That's right. They left a legacy. So why don't you do the same thing? So you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and beyond. And, you know, you can continue this discussion on the genealogy and history forum of AfroGenius.com and research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. And, of course, always remember to listen to the African Roots podcast with Angela Walton Raji on Friday morning. And you just heard Antoinette Harrell, Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Thank you so much for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond and for helping me celebrate my second anniversary. Check out the YouTube slideshow that I put together. Just thanking you. I just really appreciate all of the guests. So just keep calling, keep joining the show. Hey, it's fun. The hour will go by before you even know it. So good night, everyone. I look forward to you joining me next Thursday. Good night. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett. Good night.